Welcome to the Thriving Artist Podcast, a feature of the Clark Healings Fund for visual artists. The Clark Healings Fund exists to provide training, introductions, and funding for working artists, to turn working artists into thriving artists. I'm Daniel DeGree, your host, and our guest today is Molly Dilworth. From the roofs of Brooklyn to the pedestrian plazas of Times Square, Molly Dilworth has created her geometrically inspired site-specific installations across the United States to highlight invisible structures and hidden motivation. She is currently a fellow in the first year of the Tulsa Artist Fellowship, and on April 23rd will unveil her sculptural commission for a new Denver light rail station at 40th and Airport. For those of you in Denver, be sure and visit the 40th and Airport station after April 23rd to see Molly's work. Now, Molly was also a Clark Healings Fund 2013 Business Accelerator Grant finalist. Welcome to the show, Molly.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We know you're an artist, of course. Can you take a minute to tell us a little bit in your own words about your background and what you do for a living?
Sure. I have been a painter for a long time, and I went to grad school in New York about 15 years ago. And I, like everyone, applied for everything. And then I got sort of frustrated by doing that, so I just started making stuff out in the world on my own. And I started making big paintings to be seen by Google Earth. I mean, that sort of unleashed a whole set of possibilities that I didn't anticipate. It was sort of more like a solution to a problem that I had, you know, expensive city and not a lot of studio space.
So for those who don't know what Google Earth is, can you kind of give us a quick 30-second explanation for the layperson?
Oh, sure. Yeah, so Google Earth is, you can go and look up an address and they send out cameras on the street to shoot the street front. But you can also look at an address and see it from above. And that was kind of the area of Google Earth that I was interested in. So that it actually, you know, many cities and a lot of the Earth is mapped by satellite. So you can see, you know, where streets go and you can zoom in and see the actual rooftops or your backyard or trees.
I used to use it to look at my own backyard and look at sort of the shape of it and how it connected with other backyards in the neighborhood to determine what the ecology was, you know, where is the tree line originally, where does the water flow? But it's pretty great, you know, you can actually see it if you've painted your roof. So it's a great way to get some art on record, for that matter. Well, let me ask you, how did you start, Molly, doing public commissions?
Well, so I think in about 2008 when Google Earth was new, I was thinking a lot about how suddenly I lived half in the digital world, like a lot of other people. And I, you know, it was just this kind of unconsidered space. Like I'm on my phone and I'm walking around and I'm sort of where I am, but I'm also where the person I'm talking to is, but I don't really know where that is. And they might not know where I am or not, you know, connected to the physical landline anymore. And so I just thought that's so weird. We're sort of half living in this world that we don't even really, like, what does it feel like to be a body in that world? So I started, it took a while to actually figure out how to scale up, how to get a site, how to get materials, how do the materials work. And it happened, so all the research and kind of getting access to that stuff took a long time. But once I figured it out, it happened pretty quickly that I got a couple of sites. And then I think that was in 2009. And then right around that time, the city of New York closed Broadway to car traffic and made the pedestrian plazas there. So they had a call for a commission to paint 5 blocks of Broadway there in Times Square that they had closed. And I applied, like 200 other people around the world, and I won it. So that was really the first big public commission. And it opened a lot of doors, and, you know, it was like proof of concept and gave people confidence that it could actually do this kind of scale project.
Well, you do big works inherently, and, you know, especially murals and installations. What are some of the challenges that you face doing that type of work?
Well, for the painting outside, I mean, I learned a lot in the couple of projects I did before I got Times Square, just about really practical things, like how do you get to the site? I mean, the first site I did, it was a little 10 by 10 foot patch, and it was on the roof of this materials recycling place in Queens called Build a Green. And, you know, I just didn't know, like, I did it in July, and it was a black roof, so it was about 120 degrees up there. I didn't have, you know, access to water up there. And I had a ladder. I had 2 ladders, but one was really unsafe. Like, there were a lot of problems with the starting out. So, you know, then in my mind, I just started a list of things that I would need for the next project, like access to a sink, access to a bathroom, you know, a stairway or something. And So each time I do a project, I just sort of add more knowledge. When it came to Times Square, just even laying out the project was quite tricky because I had to have plans that were approved by the city. But luckily, the crew that I work with, they do a lot of street painting and they paint the bridges and everything. So they had all kinds of surveyor's tools that I didn't know about. So, you know, I had a very, I had a good idea how to scale up, but I didn't know exactly what I was doing, which is something that I really love about working this way. Often, for commissions, you have the site and you have a budget and you have a lot of parameters. But for non-commissioned work or semi-commissioned work, it's always a matter of getting the funding together, the site, and the materials, sometimes community partners. So there are always, you know, many different partners that I'm working with and many different little things that come up that you have to problem solve or fix or find advocates to help make the project actually happen.
So obviously you're putting art in spaces that you don't completely control in order to be seen by Google Earth satellites. And there are various things about the project that you mentioned that are constraints, such as budget. But you've been quoted as saying you don't want to ask permission for your art. So what do you mean by that? How does that work?
Well, often I do have to ask permission. I mean, it's funny because sometimes people think, oh, it's like really big graffiti or something. But the thing is, the project takes so long to make that it's not something that could happen in a few hours or even a few days. So I don't know. I mean, I guess it really depends on the project. Like if for commission work, I do have to not ask permission. I mean, for commission work, you're often given permission, but it's a negotiation about what you can do or not do. But I think maybe what I meant when I was saying that is I don't want to have a concept or work with a site or a specific history or the research that I'm doing and have to tell a story that I wouldn't want to tell or change the design to a work that looked like someone else's work or something like that. So I guess there's the conceptual idea of asking for permission and then the practical aspect of asking for permission. And I think maybe also what I meant by permission was in the beginning, like I was saying, I applied to lots of things, like a lot of artists do. And, you know, you get these rejections where it's like 500 people have applied for this, 3,000 people have applied, you know, we regret to inform you. And so in the early days, I thought, well, I can try to get through this door that everyone's trying to get through, or I can just go find a space that nobody is trying to get to. You know, there's plenty of places in the world that could use art and that I don't have to submit applications for. For me, that was really critical to getting going, you know, not having someone say, oh, yes, we like your work. It's just go out and make the work and people can find it.
So you also have to deal, given that this work is outdoors, with a variety of things, timing, weather, location are not always in your control, for planning for the art to be noticed by Google satellites. So how do you coordinate all this? How do you plan for it? Does it always turn out the way that you've planned?
Of course not. I mean, it's funny. I definitely learned the hard way that, you know, we all know you can't control weather, but sometimes if it would just start raining, I'd keep painting, thinking, oh, you know, it's just a little bit of water. But when you're painting on a vertical surface, any little bit of water adds up quickly. So I learned very quickly, like the first time I kept painting when I shouldn't have, the paint just all ran away and it was so much more trouble to fix, touch up all the areas where the one color ran over the other color that, you know, it wasn't even worth the time. So I just learned, you know, you have to react to the conditions on the ground. You can't impose your will on nature, which sounds really obvious, but in practice, sometimes you just want to finish a project. Well, the other thing is, I didn't really understand how Google Earth worked when I started making work to be seen by Google Earth. I think a lot of us if we use Google Earth, we are, you know, looking for an address or directions or something. So we're very often seeing the street view, which is more frequently updated. But the satellite view is much less frequently updated. And so I just kind of thought in New York City, they probably photographed it every other year or something. But I didn't realize that that's not at all the case. I mean, usually they map a large city and then they don't update it maybe for 7 years or something. So I happened to be very lucky that I did a lot of these paintings in 2009 and 2010, and they re-photographed New York City in 2011. So a lot of the projects got up very quickly. I mean, it could have been a gap of many years, and the paintings could have been faded or removed, or someone could redo their roof or something. But so all of them got up there except for one painting where there was a lot of snow in 2010 and a roof needed to be repaired. So that painting didn't make it to Google Earth. Interestingly, I'm in touch with some of the engineers there, and they sent me the image of the rooftop, and they just couldn't post it because they didn't get a good enough picture of it. So I learned a lot about the way that they map any given satellite image. They have hundreds of images that they knit together. And this particular location in New York City, they had mapped it over several different days, and they knitted the picture together, but they just didn't have the right pictures to knit together. So I have this image that one of the engineers sent me where the painting, you can see three sides of the building and the roof, but the painting, some of the painting is coming down over the bricks of the building, which it's not how it actually exists in the real world. So it's just this crazy, you know, there are a lot of people who make art about glitches in Google Earth, but it was really odd to see how the knitting software works together and how things go wrong internally for Google Earth that had nothing to do with the painting or that actual photography. It's more like their system broke down as it would if you're, you know, taking photographs of the whole Earth.
You get that with human viewers and consumers of art as well. You know, they have their own set of eyes. They see what they see a certain way, and that's affected upon, affected by what they're dealing with on any given day as well. So it's interesting that a digital instrument would have a subjective perspective based on, you know, what's going on that day. Well, you've said that you want to mark a physical presence in digital space. What exactly does that mean?
Well, I mean, it really comes back to what I said before about suddenly realizing my life is really different, and not just my life. All of our lives are really different because of the digital world. And it's one of those things like you can't fight weather that sounds really obvious. But when I thought about it, I mean, it was partly a way to really think about it in an embodied way. Like I'm inserting myself into this system, which is purely digital, but I'm making something really a physical mark there. And that led to like learning a little bit about how Google Earth works, but it also, I mean, it's sort of this feedback situation too, because I had a lot of conversations and I continue to have a lot of conversations about not just Google Earth, but the digital world. So you find out what other people think about it, or you find out what engineers are doing and what's coming next. And there are all these kind of, in a way, it's like investigating the world that you're living in. When I started making these paintings, people kept saying, oh, just make a painting and, you know, you can insert the layer. There are software where you can insert the layer into on top of Google Earth so that if people enable the software, then they would, like, they wanted to find a digital way to do it. And I kept thinking, oh, that's really interesting. The whole point is to actually make something physically there, you know, not easy and clean and smooth, to sort of highlight the difference between the world that we live in that we can touch and the world that we also live in that's happening simultaneously that we can't touch, but we do interact with. Or people would ask me, oh, how far out do I have to zoom on Google Earth to see your work to be the correct resolution? And to me, that question didn't even make sense, but it was a way that other people thought about using this digital tool. For me, it was just about putting it there and sort of as a way to actually make the thing, but also to really physically and really tangle with the digital world.
I like that you have the option when someone says, where's your portfolio, to say, well, you've got to get a rocket ship and go really, really high and then look down. And that's, or the other option is use satellite imagery and you can see my portfolio. It's a unique way to do it. So, you know, it takes technology to create your work, or you are better said, you create your work for technology, precisely for a technological lens. So are there specialized technologies that you use to create the work as well?
Well, there are. In the beginning, I was really just trying to figure out how to scale things up, but I did use Photoshop. Like I would take some of my paintings and put them through a Photoshop filter to break down the colors, because any image is millions of colors. But if you start pixelating it, you can separate those millions you can sort of consolidate those millions of pixels or millions of actual colors into a narrower band of colors. And it was just a practical thing. Like, I can't get a million different paint colors to make a painting. And I didn't really want to replicate exactly the painting. So, but I have these ways of feeding physical things into digital technologies and then feeding them back out into physical technologies. So that's one thing. It's just this kind of continuous loop back and forth between the digital and physical worlds. But then now I'm working on my sculpture commission. So it's been really interesting. A fabricator is making it. They're in Denver. I'm in New York, or most of the time I was making it over in New York. So we would have Skype meetings where the fabricator's architect would have the 3D model, and we would edit the model while on a Skype call where he's sharing his screen. So it's like having robot arms for the spaceship or something, you know. He's moving the model and I'm telling him where to move or giving him notes, sometimes emailing PDFs. And but it's very interesting. Like, I kept thinking, oh, I should learn CAD or I should learn Rhino. But the reality is I would never learn it well enough to design the thing I need to design. Or I wouldn't, you know, there's someone out there that has those skills. So it's also the technology of language is really there. I'm like, I don't know how to use the program, so I'm not sure how to instruct the architect how to do it. So, and even in that case, I built a little paper model, which is pretty ridiculous. But it's funny because we don't think of language as a technology, but there are all these overlapping systems that we're constantly engaging with that we're more and less familiar with. But the fabrication and the Rhino and the digital technology of building a big sculpture is all very new to me.
Well, let me ask you about the context for the work as well, because your work often takes over undervalued and underappreciated spaces. Why is that?
Well, it really started practically. Like I was saying, everybody wanted to get to these same doors, and I started to notice, and it was partly through Google Earth, that, I mean, you could actually see all these unused spaces. But even in a city as dense as New York, there are lots of, I don't even know if they're pocket parks, like overused or overlooked civic spaces. There are a lot of community gardens, but there are also lots that are derelict. So there are always these little pockets and areas that you can find. And I feel like that was just my reaction to a city that is very dense and very programmed, and there's advertising space everywhere, you know, in every subway car. So it sort of felt like, oh, in some ways, it feels like all the space is taken, but if you're really looking, there's, you know, plenty of space that people don't care about. It's just the sort of space that's programmed are, you know, because it is programmed, those are the spaces we tend to see. So I like the places that are hidden in plain sight. Like, I've often installed, you know, aside from the public artwork, in an exhibition, you know, I will think, oh, everybody wants the wall space, or they want the good, you know, space where everyone will see it right when they walk in the door. So in a practical but maybe a slightly contrarian way, I think, oh, well, nobody wants to hang way up by the ceiling. Like, I can have basically the whole square footage of the gallery, but just, you know, so high up. I don't have to fight anyone for that space. And I kind of like this idea that the people who are attentive will maybe see the things that are hidden in plain sight, or maybe are already looking for the things that are hidden away. So it's a little bit like a treasure hunt.
I think you've warmed the hearts of fans of James Caan, that 80s movie, Hide in Plain Sight. I love this concept. I want to shift gears now, though, and take you off of the topic of your art in particular and focus on the topic of your business. So so the question is this: do you make a living from your art?
I do make a living from my art most years, not every year. Like, for example, last year, a commission, or 2 years ago, a big commission got moved to a different year. So it was kind of a bit of a financial, not a disaster, but it was a hiccup for sure. And I went back to freelancing a little bit, more or less for about 6 years. I've either worked full time or more than part time on my work and made a living at it.
So you work primarily based off of commissions, but how do you find enough commissions to earn a living?
Well, there are a lot of sites that host public art commissions, or that post them, and so I'm constantly looking through those sites that post requests for proposals. I sometimes get invited to do commissions. That's, you know, a lot less frequent than me preparing proposals. And then it's funny, I was just telling another artist about this. I'm often a finalist for a commission, but I don't get it. And very often when they have the finalist proposals, they'll have all the finalists come and, you know, they just present one after another. Or there's a site visit or something. So you'll meet some of the other finalists. And it's funny, it's such a good network of people because they're all applying for commissions too, but they often know about commissions in other cities or sites where you're not aware of them. So it's just information. It's such a generous community, at least that's been my experience. We'll share a lot of information between ourselves because even though we may be competing for the same commissions, we all know that, you know, you don't always get every commission that you're a finalist for. So it's better to share that information among each other because it's relative to the number of artists in the U.S. or around the world. The ones who are actively doing commissions are a pretty small group, and we have we all need fabricators, or we all need to know how to do budgets, or we all run into similar kinds of problems. So it's very helpful to have a community that's that specific to ask questions about, hey, have you run into this, or do you know about this? So it's a very, so that's also a resource for finding not just commissions, but information and help on your projects.
So I like that you're calling out the need to go looking for RFPs, requests for proposals, and that brings us right around to sort of contracts and negotiations. So when do you get paid? At what point, what stage do you get paid? And is this part of the contract negotiation?
So normally, for most commissions, you get paid to present your proposal. And it's everybody thinks, oh, that's so great, until they start working on one. Because it's, depending on the size of the commission, it's somewhere between $500 and a couple thousand dollars. But usually, when you're making your proposal, it's often pretty close to what you actually make. So like for me, for Denver, I had to contact fabricators and I had to write the whole budget and make the designs, maybe not the most elaborate designs, but do all the research about, you know, what the project is about. So like for Denver, for example, it was about a 3-month process of putting together, you know, my idea for what the thing should be at this light rail station. And I think the fee is something like $1,000 or $1,200. So that's obviously not a ton of money for 3 months work. And then you get the presentation, and for that one, I was selected for the commission. So once you get selected for the commission, hypothetically, you get a contract within a few weeks. And for almost all the projects I've done, the payments are scheduled throughout the contract. So like Denver, I've been working on for about 2 years. So there are payments that are tied to milestones in completion. Sometimes I've had the experience sometimes where, I mean, this is one of my favorite topics to talk about with artists because the contract is so important. And I think that public art helped me understand contracts because most artists are afraid of them or don't like to do them or feel like it's litigious or something to have a contract. But in my experience, the contract is, aside from your presentation, it's the first contract you have with the commissioning agency. And so you get to work out everything about what's going to happen. It's the, you know, the first communication you have. And so really you get to negotiate usually the time frame and the payments and all the scheduled stuff is not negotiable, but there's everything else is I wouldn't say negotiable, but how to best say this? I mean, most public art contracts or most public art pieces are just like other artworks. They're all different. And so even if there's a really great contract, there may be things in your particular project that the commissioning agent has never seen before. So those specific things are not going to be in your contract. So it's, I don't know, I really like the contracting phase because you get to really start talking about how you're going to work together with someone. And it can be really intimidating. I know people haven't read a lot of contracts before, but I just think, I mean, I used to be scared of them too, and I feel like, and so I understand the fear, but I also understand the power of really feeling comfortable with thinking of them as a conversation.
I think that is a constructive way to think about them. And also, you get to set the conditions, the environment, the context for your work. And isn't that to a certain degree, the dream of the artist to be able to work under their own terms, their own conditions, their own context that is predefined. It's not something we're bewildered about. It's not something we worry about or agonize over. And so the contract buys you that ability for an extended period of time. So I love that you're calling out all of the things that make a project go. It starts with the proposal, it goes to the contract, and then I want to ask you about the finances part. We asked about when you get paid, but have you ever been burned by a client not paying? Are there collections issues as well?
I think, it's a great question. I haven't, that hasn't actually happened to me in public art or in commissioned work in these large scale things, but it has happened to me before I really understood how this kind of negotiation works. I mean, I talk about it a lot with designers because they're a lot better about billing and just setting up these kind of clear communication. What I would say is that what often happens with these works is that, you know, you do your presentation, you're a finalist, you're selected, and then you don't get a contract. And very often artists will keep working, or like I've been asked to redesign a color scheme or just do redesigns on my selected project. And I've learned to always ask to be paid for the redesign. And I always say, you know, this, and sometimes I build redesigns into my budget when I'm presenting, just so that people know, you know, we can negotiate a little bit about how this is actually going to look. But I build it in there because artists will often redesign and before they're even under contract. And if you don't have a contract, then you don't have any agreement to actually make the work. So what you're really doing then is working for free. So for me, like, asking for things like redesigns or any work outside of a contract is not only a way to protect myself, so to make sure that I'm not working for free, and it's also a way to sort of encourage the commissioning agency into writing the contract. Because sometimes you never know what's going on with an organization. They could lose their funding. There could be, like, I had one experience where there was a mudslide in the town where I was doing a project. So suddenly they had, you know, their engineers had a huge problem. They had a budget situation that they weren't expecting, and the project eventually went away. But before all of that happened, they asked me to redesign, I think, 3 or 4 times. And by then I had known, okay, well, I'm going to have to invoice you for the redesigns. It's in the budget. So when we do get the contract, those redesigns will just come out of the design fee, which is already built into the contract. But I can't do it since I don't have a contract. So I invoice them. You know, so I did get paid for the redesigns, even though the project never happened. So I think that it's really important to know, to protect yourself as an artist, because, you know, without an agreement, then you really don't, you haven't agreed to work together officially. And so they don't have to pay you for a project that didn't happen, but you might still do work on that project, even though the project didn't happen.
I think you're singing our song. You know, this is exactly what it would be if there was an engineering project, if there was a project to provide marketing services, or any other, you know, a building project, any type of project should ideally be protected by a contract. And so you don't work off contract, and then the contract is protected in the contract by clauses that deal with things like what happens if we ask for X for additional revisions? Are there some included? Are there some, is anything beyond a certain amount not included? You know, and it stipulates what happens and when you get paid and if you get paid. You know, not liking contracts, that's fine. I don't know anybody that just loves contracts to love contracts, but not having contracts is a recipe for disaster in any kind of business or creative field. So I love that you're dealing with that. Part of what's in and around the contract and in and around the cost that you have to think about when you're setting your pricing is, for every project, you have to sort of have a budget, and you have to factor in all your materials, any mishaps, and your own take-home pay. So how do you do that?
Yeah, I mean, that's something I've gotten better at with experience. In general, the artist fee is 20% of the full budget of the piece. And then, I mean, I have a couple different templates that I got from commissioning agencies about, you know, standard artist budgets. And they always say, you know, don't use this as your budget, but they just have line items in there that are things that you might not think about. Like I learned what a contingency was by writing a budget. I didn't even know what that was, and I used to not include them. So there are certain standard things. I feel like sometimes it depends on the project, but often I pay myself for labor as separate from the artist fee because, you know, if I'm out there working 40 hours a week or sometimes more for a month and I'm hiring people to help me install a piece, I'm paying the worker, I'm paying the people that I hired, but I'm also paying myself because when I'm on that scaffold, you know, painting in the hot sun for 14 hours a day, that's also labor. And it's not, you know, I have had projects where I didn't pay myself for that. And it gets a little crazy when you're working out your budget because even if you're paying yourself the artist fee, if you're on site for a month working, you're not doing anything else during that month. So not only is it crazy to work for free, but you're also basically booked, so you can't be working on something else. So it's partly budgeting and time management. And I feel like a lot of times artists just, you know, their own labor, you know, it's kind of a cliche, but it's true. We don't get paid because we do it anyway. But, I don't bill for every hour that I spend in the studio, but it's been really helpful for me to work on public projects because you do have to account for your time and you do have to bill for labor and things like that when you're working on a project.
So what advice do you have about ensuring that your process as an artist or that another person's process as an artist is this professional? Do they need to engage an attorney to help them with, you know, to create the contracts? Should they download a standard one online? What is it that you recommend so that they have a professionalized budget, a professionalized contract, and a professionalized way of completing proposals? Or do you have recommendations?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you live in New York, I would definitely say go take classes from the Volunteer Lawyers for the Arts. They have great training, great classes. Many of them are free. I feel like there are a lot of resources online. Like Creative Capital has great webinars. A lot of other organizations do. I recommend that instead of downloading a form online from like a legal site, just because the discipline of the artist often has specific conditions, just like any other business, that are different from other businesses. So I feel like if you start in the field of art and then look for legal resources around there, you'll be way ahead of the game because, you know, people who work in your discipline, even if it's not public art, you could be a dancer or something. But if you start in the sort of creative realm, you'll have people that already have a knowledge of the kind of specific conditions there and the things that can go wrong. So I feel like if you start there, you're just better off because if you get a boilerplate contract for like a restaurant contract or something, you might be just, you know, doing yourself more damage because you'll be editing. You don't even know what you're editing. It doesn't have anything to do with the project you're actually working on.
Well, let's deal with the liability and responsibility sort of side of things. So in most commissions, you're responsible for the commission work for up to 10 years. But if the work is physically outside, how do you budget or provide for its maintenance? And legally, what are you responsible for during that 10-year span?
Yeah, it's tricky. So it was really easy for me, or it has been pretty easy for me when there are paint commissions, because I've worked with more or less the same materials or similar materials for many years, and I've watched them age and gone back to the sites and seen how they age over time. So for paint, it's relatively easy. You're more or less mapping colors, and you can touch things up if you need to. For the sculpture, that's a conversation I had with the fabricators about the materials they'd be using to build the piece, and I had a lot of questions for them about just their construction process and where they thought it would be likely that things could break down. And then there's also just practical things you have to think about the site. Like this piece in Denver is at a light rail station going on the facade. So there are cars coming and going, but the sculpture is really far from cars. And it's also, there's going to be some, not trees, but like low bushes in front of the sculpture. So it's pretty hard to, I mean, you can physically walk up and touch it, but it's got a couple of layers of things in between, so it makes it a little harder for people to get to. And I mean, hypothetically, a car could careen out of the parking lot and slam into it, and then I would have a real problem because my maintenance plan for this piece is a lot more about touching up the paint and not about rebuilding it.
Right. So you also have the image of materials getting lost or a storm damaging the project, you know, and the need to insure the project against such damage or loss or theft, et cetera, or vandalism. Is there special insurance you have to do? Is there anything that we need to think about insuring a large public work like this while the project is proceeding?
Well, normally there's a lot of insurance that's involved when the piece is being made and installed. In terms of the liability, that's usually what, that's the only point that it's insured. And then all of the stuff about what could happen over the next 10 years or for the life of the piece or whatever, all of that stuff this is why contracts are so important. All of that stuff is spelled out in the contract. So, you know, you have a negotiation about what am I responsible for? If there's the light rail station burns down, I'm not responsible for that. The last project I did was along the side of a highway. And so we had, We had conversations about acts of God, you know, if a lightning strikes and the building burns down, if a semi careens off the highway and smashes into the building, because the contract, when I got it, as it was written, was that if anything happened for any reason, I was responsible. And I didn't sign that contract. You know, we had a long conversation back and forth, just to make sure that we agree. I mean, they also didn't think it was fair that if a semi came off the highway and totaled the building, that I should have to remake the piece for when I couldn't remake the piece because the building wouldn't be there to paint it on. So instead of, you know, freaking out, oh, this contract is so terrible, we just had a real conversation about what is my responsibility realistically and what is the responsibility of the commissioning agency. And it was a great conversation because, you know, they weren't trying to get, you know, they weren't out to get me. They just wanted to make a great piece, and same on my side. So those conversations and negotiations are really important because mostly things don't go wrong. But when they do go wrong, you want to have a game plan and you want to have your partner, you know, you want to agree to what the game plan is ahead of time. Because when things go wrong, you know, everybody is just, it's every man for himself and it gets pretty chaotic. So it's really important to walk through what are we going to do? Who's responsible?
So I love that you're making contracts less scary by pointing out that, you know, it's a conversation and the contract is not a thing in and of itself that precedes the conversation. It's a memorialization of what the conversation is, what the agreement has been. You're sort of formalizing what you've come to. So I think a lot of people look at contracts as scary because they think, oh, they've handed me a contract, I'm powerless, I have to accept this or reject it. That's very far from the truth, as you pointed out. Or that, you know, if I get involved in challenging the contract, I'll necessarily lose the client and all of that. And that's not true either. So I love that you're sort of talking about how contracts are fluid until you actually have a contract. And then the contract represents the discussion so far and you sign it. So that sort of brings up two different issues that I want to ask about. One is, how do you navigate the desires of the client aesthetically, not just contract-wise, not just for the terms, you know, the commission and all of that, but how do you navigate those aesthetic desires while staying true to yourself artistically?
Yeah, that can be a really tricky thing. I feel like I have a lot of different strategies and tactics when it comes to that. In a prior project, I won a commission and I had a very specific color scheme. And part of the reason I had that color scheme was there were a lot of problems with the surface I was working on, including like rusty metal that would leak onto the surface. So the color scheme was pretty dark. And they asked me to redesign the color scheme. They thought it was too dark and heavy. And there were other reasons that I chose this dark palette. And I explained to them, I didn't say no, I didn't say yes. I just explained to them the reasons why I chose those colors. And I empathized with their desire. You know, they thought it was too dark and heavy. So I explained to them I'd be happy to redesign, but I explained that there would be some problems. There was only so light I could go because the metal leaking and all the reasons why I chose that palette. So sometimes I wasn't going to try to argue and stick to my plan because they didn't like that plan, and that's totally fine with me. For me, I feel like I'm one of these artists who is iterative. Like, I don't make the, despite making big public works, I never make or the way I think of it is I don't make one masterpiece. I make like many, many iterations. So even all the public projects have like sometimes, you know, 150 test paintings that go along with them. So I feel like it's kind of a little bit like the contract in that, you know, I have something, they want something. And if they don't match up, we figure out a way to make it match up. And I have to figure out how to make something that I'm happy with and I'm proud of and I actually want to make. And I have to do that in a way that they're happy. And I often, just like with designers, clients, I often don't know what it is. Sometimes it's just 20 people on a panel and everybody wants their 2 cents. And so I guess I have a lot of different tactics about how to negotiate something that I want. Sometimes, like in one case, someone asked me to make several designs because they wanted to do a social media thing where people could vote on one of their favorite designs, which I really didn't like. I mean, I knew why they wanted to do it, but I just think art by committee is not a good idea. If you do that, why are you commissioning someone to do something? But because I'm an artist who's iterative, it was very easy for me to present out of, you know, 80 designs, my 3 favorite. So it didn't matter what people voted on, all 3 of them I would be perfectly happy to make. So it really depends on your practice, but I think it's, at least I would say, there's always room for movement or negotiation. But I think that if you're making something you don't want to make, that's not, at least for me, that's not okay. I mean, what's the point? And I also think when people are choosing your work or commissioning you, they like what you do. So it's not a disaster if they don't love every single choice you've made, but you have to find a way to, you know, find some wiggle room in your own practice so that your, you know, the commissioning agency likes it. But I also think that doesn't mean abandon your own aesthetics. And definitely you should not make things that you don't believe in or like. So, but you know what I'm saying? It's not an on-off switch. There's room for movement in there.
So in addition to this, you know, many of your works are only semi-permanent. So when you commit, essentially you're committing to a length of time. And I like how we said that contracts are not absolute, that the desires of yourself as an artist and the desires of the client, neither of those are absolute, but these are all fluid too, but so is the artwork. So how do you feel about that? That your art doesn't last forever where it's...
Well, it's funny. I actually love that. I mean, the trickiest thing is communicating to people that is the case. Like sometimes people say, oh, how long is it going to last? And, you know, rooftops generally last around 10 years. I mean, it's sort of the same. It's sort of like a building engineering thing or something. But for me, also working out in the world, I kind of like not having control over it. I mean, of course, I don't want it to be destroyed right away. And when I first started working outside, I worked on a rooftop that had a lot of people hang out on this rooftop. So I thought it would just get tagged and everything right away, and I was surprised, like people actually really took care of it and they didn't tag it and destroy it. But for me, there's something really nice about you put something out in the world and you don't have any control. You don't have a life of its own. And practically it's like, I don't have to store it. I don't have to frame it. I don't have to move it around to art fair. So for me, there's something very freeing about, you know, whatever happens to it is going to happen to it. And I even, like, especially when I work on rooftops, I always joke, sometimes people come up and a bird poops on the rooftop and people are like, oh no, you know, your work got damaged. And I always think that's when it gets christened, is the first bird that poops on it, because, you know, things are going to happen to it. It's only a matter of time.
Yeah, so it's also a dialogue with nature and the social environment. That's profound. There's a lot here that's really interesting in how you approach the art. Maybe some lessons for those of us that are more rigid. So the work is also placed out in everyday spaces where it's very accessible. So that seems to be an upside to doing it this way. People can get to your art. It's not traditionally are always locked away in a museum somewhere, or sorry, the gallery closes at 5.
Right. Yeah. People are always saying like, oh, I'm sorry. I mean, I have shows inside too sometimes, but people always say, oh, I'm sorry, I missed the opening, or I didn't see your exhibition because it's a month or it's 2 months. And I always say, oh, it's there. You know, all you have to do is walk down the street or go on Google Earth. It's really nice to have, you know, have it be not behind a paywall and free and accessible to people. I really like that. And also, yeah, you have an audience, so it's not just an art audience, which is really exciting to me.
So do you have work in galleries also, and do you create special smaller pieces just for that, or are galleries really a part of your career?
I do make work for galleries. Like I said, I'm an iterative artist, so often with these big public projects, there'll be these small study paintings. So I have those, and I also grew up in the Midwest with a mom who was a weaver. So I've been making craft stuff my whole life. So in my studio, I have a whole separate studio practice where I'm making all these objects and little paintings. So I show those too. I've been thinking a lot. And sometimes they're shown in the same place. Sometimes they're shown separately. But it's a little bit research projects. It's a little bit of everything. Like, it can be their own things, but they have a relationship to these larger projects out in the world. So they're not always separate, but as far as they're presented out in the world, they do feel very separate. Like, often people will know about my public work, but never, like, I make these little embroideries, and, you know, you would never look at these little embroideries and think about huge public paintings. I'm more interested in the things. Well, I'm interested in both practices, but the thing about working out in the world is there's all this really urgent problem solving that needs to happen, and materials research and working with other people. So that in some ways is often the most exciting part of the practice. And then sometimes I need to retreat and not, you know, look at contracts or spend time pulling permits. And you know, sometimes I just want to go in the studio and play. So they're kind of complementary practices, I guess.
Well, we'll wind down the show by asking about sort of your current projects. You've recently had your first permanent sculptural commission. You've recently had that accepted and have begun to get it ready for the reveal at the Denver Light Rail Station that we mentioned at the start of the show. How does that feel?
It's really exciting. This one is especially exciting to me because I know how to make big paintings out in the world, and I still like doing that. But for the last couple of years, I've been applying for commissions for things I don't know how to do. And so this is the first time I've really gotten one that is not only just someone else is making it. I mean, I designed it, but I'm not touching, I won't see it until it's opened. But it's the first time in a couple of years that I've done something that I absolutely don't know how to do and could be a complete, not disaster, but it, you know, might not work. So I'm sort of, that's what I've been working on for the last couple of years and continue to work on, is doing things, you know, adding to my repertoire, stretching, doing new kinds of problem solving. So that it's really exciting that it's opening. I can't wait to see it. And it just happens to be on the light rail that goes to the airport from downtown. So I just happen to be on that line. They're building a bunch of lines in Denver, but everyone is really, the airport's pretty far from downtown. So people are especially excited about this particular line. So it's going to be, you know, it's gonna be always nice to have a big project finish. But for me, this project also represents growth in the way that I'm working. So that's really like the big excitement for me.
So I'm gonna wind our show down with two final questions. One is there a watershed moment or one thing that led to your success as a working artist or an artist in business? Or is it a constellation of things? But can you mark a moment?
I think it's a constellation of things, but I do have to say in 2008, I went to be an artist in residence at the Pacific Northwest College of Art in Portland. And, you know, the economy fell apart in New York during that semester when I was away. And when I came back, a lot of the businesses that I had worked for had gone out of business. And I had old bosses of mine calling me and saying, you know, do you know anyone who's hiring? And even though it was a really painful time, and, you know, I'm glad it's not 2008 anymore, for me, that was a real watershed moment because I went to have an interview at a gallery to be an archivist, and it was a full-time volunteer job. And I went to the interview, and there was a curator from the Guggenheim who had been laid off who also interviewed for the job. And I thought to myself, I'm willing to pay to work for free for someone else. As long as I'm willing to do that for someone else, why won't I do it for myself? So at that was the real moment for me that the gauntlet kind of got thrown down. Like, you have to throw in for yourself. You know, you have to take this seriously. So again, it was not it was a really terrible time for a lot of people losing their jobs. And it was also financially and emotionally everything very hard for me. But I'm not sure I would have, I don't know if I would have been so wholeheartedly excited about doing working for myself if I hadn't been sort of forced in a way to do it by the economic downturn.
That is strong motivation, and has been for a lot of people to found their business. So you're definitely not alone. One last question. So if you were to give one piece of advice to emerging artists for how what it is they need to be successful in business, if you could sum it up as do X and you will succeed, what might that be?
That's a good question. I really think that finding a community of people and experts and mentors that you trust and who will challenge you, I really feel like that is essential to moving forward. It's a hard job to be an artist, and I think it's really important to sort of lean on your colleagues for when you need advice or when you run into problems. It's sort of like what I was saying about the legal stuff or the contract stuff before. You know, what we do is really specific, and so it's helpful to have experts in that field advise you. And I mean, artists love to be mentors. I feel like we really like to be contacted. So it could even be someone you don't know well. It's worth asking for a mentor, and just make sure that your community is really strong and supportive.
Obviously something that we care a great deal about at the Clark Healings Fund, our grant program for our business accelerator grants focus heavily on education, mentorship, contacts, funding at critical moments, and a tool set. So, a really strong commitment to the things you're talking about that are necessary to make a business in art successful. You've been listening to the Thriving Artist Podcast, a feature of the Clark Healings Fund for Visual Artists. For more information on Molly Dilworth, visit mollydilworth.com. For information on the Clark Healings Fund, visit clarkhealingsfund.org. And be sure and follow our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Thank you for listening, and thank you, Molly. It's been really great having you.
Thank you. It was great.